The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is underwritten by the law firm of W.G. Alexander & Associates. Alexander attorneys provide top-rated and experienced legal counsel concentrating on estate planning, elder law, special needs, and asset protection. Call W.G. Alexander & Associates at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the January 28th, 2022 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing shows Russian President Vladimir Putin. He is sitting at a chess table, smiling, kind of his cryptic sort of smile, looking into the camera. And he's moving a pawn forward. His pawns are infantrymen, soldiers, and then his other pieces are a variety of missile launchers and army tanks. Interestingly, his opponent's pieces are all just checkers. We can't see the opponent. The headline is Putin on the attack. Can the U.S. and NATO stop Russia from checkmating Ukraine? That is one of our main stories this week, and we'll start with that. Fears rise that Russia will invade Ukraine. What happened? President Biden said this week that he expects Russian President Vladimir Putin will invade Ukraine, even as U.S. officials engaged in frantic diplomatic efforts to avert what could become Europe's largest conflict since World War II. During a hastily arranged visit to Kiev, Secretary of State Antony Blinken promised continued U.S. support to the government of Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, including $200 million in additional military aid. The meeting, the first in a series of emergency talks with European and Russian officials, came as the Kremlin intensified preparations for a possible invasion. With 100,000 Russian troops already deployed along the Ukrainian border, Moscow sent forces to Belarus, which borders Ukraine, for previously unannounced military drills. Russia is also emptying its embassy in Kiev and is believed to have been behind a string of cyber attacks on Ukrainian government sites. "My guess is Putin will move in," said Biden, "but I think he will pay a serious and dear price for it." U.S. intelligence agencies said Russia might use a false flag operation to justify an invasion, possibly by attacking Moscow-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine, attacks it would then blame on Kiev. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov called that report total disinformation and said the U.S. can de-escalate tensions by accepting Russia's security demands, which include the withdrawal of NATO troops from member nations that border Russia and the barring of Ukraine and other ex-Soviet republics from the alliance. The U.S. and its European allies have called those demands non-starters. Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov said that if talks with the U.S. were unsuccessful, he couldn't exclude the possibility of his country placing military infrastructure in Cuba or Venezuela. What the editorial said: the window of opportunity for a diplomatic solution in Ukraine is rapidly closing, if it were ever really open, said the Washington Post. President Biden's team has handled negotiations skillfully, refusing to cave on Ukraine's sovereignty, while offering to engage with Russian President Vladimir Putin on arms control and other issues. But this was never likely to satisfy Putin, who manufactured this crisis as part of his long-term project to restore Russian hegemony over the former Soviet empire. "All we can do now is bolster the Ukrainian military and hope Putin grasps the high price he'll pay for an invasion. What happened to the tough-on-Putin rhetoric Democrats spouted when Donald Trump was president, asked the Washington Examiner. The party could have delivered a major blow against Putin by backing a Republican proposal to restore Trump-era sanctions on the newly built Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which will deliver Russian natural gas to Germany. But to appease Berlin, Democrats have refused to get on board. When the pipeline comes online, Putin will be able to demand that European governments turn a blind eye to his aggression as the price of heating their nations, homes, and businesses. What the columnist said. Biden is threatening tough sanctions on Russia if it invades Ukraine, said Walter Russell Mead in the Wall Street Journal. But that's not enough. Regimes in smaller, poorer countries like Cuba and North Korea have survived sanctions more severe than any Russia is likely to face. The only thing that will deter Putin from marching west is the one the White House insists is off the table, dispatching an American and coalition force to defend Ukraine. There's no chance the U.S. and Europe will send troops to fight Russia and risk triggering a world war, said Peter Beinart in the New York Times. So let's make a deal. Admitting Ukraine to NATO hasn't been on the table for a long time. And with some artful diplomatic language, the West could let Moscow claim it has veto power over Kiev's alliances, while leaving open the possibility of future membership. The U.S. can acknowledge Russia's sphere of influence without inviting a war we're not willing to fight. Whether he launches an invasion or not, Putin may come to regret his imperial act, said Frieda Gittes in CNN.com. The more he bullies Russia's neighbors, the more they will turn to the West for protection. Once neutral Sweden and Finland are now talking about joining NATO. An Eastern European NATO member such as Poland and Hungary that once lived under the Kremlin's boot are surely experiencing a newfound appreciation for the alliance. If what Putin wanted was attention, he got that. But he has also succeeded in making the West more unified than it has been in decades. Controversy of the week is January 6. Will the full conspiracy be revealed? The Department of Justice just went there on sedition, said Marshall Cohen in CNN.com. In a watershed moment in the January 6 investigation, Attorney General Merrick Garland last week unveiled charges against 11 Oath Keepers, including leader Stuart Rhodes, for seditious conspiracy, which carries a possible prison sentence of up to 20 years. The 17-count indictment alleges that the far-right militia members made a highly organized, explicit attempt to overthrow the U.S. government by stopping the peaceful transfer of power from Donald Trump to Joe Biden. Rhodes, the indictment said, told the Oath Keepers to prepare for a bloody civil war and conducted combat training sessions and amassed a so-called quick reaction force in Virginia with a stockpile of military-grade weapons. So much for a cherished right-wing talking point, said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine. For months, conservatives such as Pat Buchanan, Ben Shapiro, and Tucker Carlson insisted that the lack of sedition charges meant that January 6 couldn't have been an insurrection. Actually, it meant that criminal charges, especially for complex planned crimes, often take a long time. These new charges are ominous for Donald Trump and his allies, said Charlie Sykes in The Bulwark. Clearly, both the DOJ and January 6 committee are digging into the larger conspiracy to overturn the presidential election, with growing evidence it was coordinated by Trump's inner circle. The smoking guns are littered all around us. In December, conservative lawyer John Eastman wrote a memo for Trump's legal team laying out how Vice President Mike Pence might reject electoral votes from states where Trump supporters made the outcome appear to be in dispute. Trump spokeswoman Kayleigh McEnany talked publicly about alternate slate of electors being submitted to Congress. Last week, news reports revealed that fake Electoral College certificates from seven swing states were submitted to the National Archives, all based on the same template. Where did the Oath Keepers fit in? Their job was to use violence to intimidate or block Pence and lawmakers from certifying the electoral votes, and to create enough chaos and uncertainty to keep Trump in power. It's now clear that January 6 was no spontaneous riot, said Lawrence Tribe and Dennis Aftergut in NBCNews.com. For the first time, the sedition indictment shows the Justice Department's confidence that it can prove the violence was planned and organized. The investigation may now move on to bigger targets. Federal prosecutors had already gotten the cooperation of four Oath Keepers, and one of the 11 newly charged had provided security to Trump advisor Roger Stone the day before. The DOJ appears to be methodically working its way up the chain of command. But will the DOJ eventually bring charges against Trump himself? Asked former federal prosecutor Ankush Kordori in Politico. In theory, it's possible if prosecutors can prove Trump took part in or was aware of the conspiracy. But if Garland were out for Trump's head, he would probably be pursuing more direct lines of inquiry, such as investigating Trump's notorious call pressuring Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger to find him 11,800 votes. For the DOJ to criminally charge Trump, someone involved in the conspiracy would have to flip on him. Given the gravity of indicting an ex-president, it would have to be a witness with some credibility, such as former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. Is that possible? Yes, but for those wondering if Trump will be charged, there are good reasons to be dubious. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for defying Beijing after China's Olympic Organizing Committee warned foreign athletes they may face punishment for speech that violates Chinese laws and regulations at the 2022 Winter Games. It was a good week for high-tech solutions after officials in Sunnyvale, California, decided to test green lasers to drive away the thousands of crows that have filled the city's downtown with cawing and droppings. The lasers are expensive, said Mayor Larry Klein, but it's far better than spending hundreds of dollars to spray wash the sidewalks every few weeks. And it was a good week for denial after the Alt Bar Pub in Donegal, Ireland, instituted a COVID fine jar into which any patron who dares to speak the name of the contagious disease currently ravaging humanity must deposit €2, about $2.28. But it was a bad week for Chamath Palihapitiya, the billionaire co-owner of the Golden State Warriors, who defended the NBA's billion-dollar business relationship with China's regime by saying, "Nobody cares what's happening to the Uyghurs, okay?" It was a bad week for regression, with reports that for years, Britain's Prince Andrew, 61, ordered staff at Buckingham Palace to carefully arrange two teddy bears and other stuffed animals on his bed. Andrew would scream and shout if the animals weren't properly placed. Finally, it was a bad week for Trumpism, after Jason Mariner, a Republican candidate who lost last week's Florida special congressional election, 79-20%, refused to concede the race. Mariner filed a lawsuit challenging the results and said, "We'll have some stuff coming out." Short in other news piece while we're here, Trump tried to interfere in the census. Top officials at the Census Bureau raised serious concerns about efforts by the Trump administration to manipulate the 2020 census, newly released documents revealed. The officials, who included Bureau Deputy Director Ron Jarman, complained in September 2020 of unprecedented intrusions by political appointees at the Commerce Department, which oversees the Bureau. Jarman's memo described Trump administration efforts to end the census count early so Trump could alter population estimates before leaving office. Trump appointees also sought to require a separate tally of undocumented immigrants and exclude them from the population count used to apportion seats in the House of Representatives. The briefing this week is titled, Mass Shooters and Misogyny. One trait connects many American men who go on shooting sprees, a history of hating women. What motivates mass shooters? The motivations of these killers are often confused, complex, or simply not known. But researchers have found that many mass shooters, who are almost entirely men, are linked by a common thread, a history of misogyny. Violence against female partners or family members, or sharing women-hating views online. A Bloomberg analysis of 749 mass shootings from 2014 to 2019, incidents in which four or more people were shot and which weren't identified as gang-related, drug-related, or robberies, found that 60% of the attacks were either acts of domestic violence or committed by men with a record of domestic violence. Omar Mateen, who killed 49 people at an Orlando gay nightclub in 2016, beat and strangled his ex-wife during their marriage. Stephen Paddock, who killed 60 people at a country music festival in Las Vegas in 2017, was known to publicly dominate and bully his live-in girlfriend. And James Hodkinson, who opened fire on 2017 Republican congressional baseball practice, had been arrested a decade earlier for hitting and choking his foster daughter. Most mass shooters have a history of domestic or family violence in their background, said Shannon Watts, founder of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. It's an important red flag. What fuels shooters' rage? Researchers say many mass shooters are driven by a distorted view of masculinity, believing that being a real man requires aggression and domination. Some feel shame over men's diminished status in the economic and social order, which they take out on the women in their lives. When it comes to male mass shooters, said Hamline University criminology professor Jillian Peterson, many think the world owes me more than what I have. Others are loners who have failed to establish relationships with women and seethe with rage over their rejection. Robert Aaron Long, who went on a shooting spree at Atlanta area massage parlors last March, said he felt tortured that he had sinned by paying for sex. He decided to remove the source of temptation by attacking three parlors and killing eight people, six of them Asian women. Do most abusers become killers? No, but the sheer number of mass shootings committed by abusers correlates with how widespread gun-related domestic violence is in America. In an average month in the U.S., more than 50 women are fatally shot by their partner. That figure alone doesn't reflect the full scale of the crisis. A 2018 University of Pennsylvania study found that some 4.5 million women have been threatened with a gun by an intimate partner, and that nearly 1 million have been shot or shot at. We really have to redouble our efforts in terms of preventing intimate partner homicide, said James Allen Fox, a criminologist at Northeastern University, especially in terms of guns. Can known abusers own guns? the Lautenberg Amendment, a 1996 amendment to an existing federal gun law, bans the possession of firearms by people convicted of certain domestic violence-related misdemeanors. Since its enactment, nearly 195,000 people have been stopped from buying guns. A 2017 study found that the amendment reduced gun murders of female intimate partners by 17%. But enforcement is patchy, and the law does not cover abuse by non-married partners without children. The boyfriend loophole, or alleged stalkers. There's also little to stop abusers from buying guns from private dealers online. Jody Lee Hunt of Westover, West Virginia, was officially barred from purchasing a gun, but he bought one on Facebook and used it to kill four people before turning it on himself. One of his victims, ex-girlfriend Sharon K. Berkshire, had filed multiple restraining orders against him. Do authorities have the power to take away guns? Red flag laws in 19 states and the District of Columbia allow courts to remove firearms from people deemed presently dangerous. And the 1994 Violence Against Women Act included a statute that barred anyone with a conviction or restraining order for domestic violence from owning guns. That law lapsed in 2019, and a revised version is facing opposition from some Republicans in the House and Senate, as well as from the National Rifle Association, which says the tweak legislation would close the boyfriend loophole in a way that is too broad and ripe for abuse. Can the killings be stopped? Experts say it would be difficult with so many firearms in circulation. There are about 120 guns for every 100 Americans. No other country has more civilian guns than people, which partly explains why the U.S.'s gun homicide rate is 25 times higher than that of other wealthy nations. For many men, gun ownership has become a way to reassert traditional masculine roles. Being a provider is actually far more difficult than it was in my father's generation, said sociologist Michael Kimmel. As the ability to be a provider has become more and more unstable, more and more threatened, men have been buying guns. Changing how we think about masculinity, said Watts, is essential to curbing mass shootings. It's really toxic masculinity that's at the root of domestic violence and mass shootings, misogyny, and easy access to guns. Bloodlust in the manosphere. Some of the worst mass shootings in recent history have been committed by incels, short for involuntary celibates, members of an online subculture of men without romantic partners who bond over a shared loathing of women. In incel chat rooms, commenters venerate Elliot Rodger, who in 2014 killed six people and then himself in Isla Vista, California, before embarking on his killing spree. The 22-year-old emailed a lengthy manifesto detailing his burning hatred for all women who rejected me through the years. That document spread throughout the so-called manosphere, and mass shooters in Southern Oregon, Toronto, Tallahassee, and elsewhere have approvingly cited Rodger. In incel lingo, going ER means copying Rodger by killing the women and normies who spurned you. These online communities are full of men who are angry and bitter and feel helpless, in some cases suicidal, said journalist David Futrell, who runs a blog monitoring the incel movement. That's going to produce more shooters in the future. Time for a few of the best columns of the week, starting with why you should avoid Omicron. Many pandemic-fatigued Americans are asking the same question, said Dr. Lena Nguyen. If fast-spreading Omicron appears to produce milder illness, than previous COVID variants in vaccinated people, why not get it over with? But inviting the virus to infect you remains a bad idea. Despite the lower rate of hospitalization caused by Omicron, the sheer volume of infections is once again overwhelming our hospitals. And if you require emergency treatment, your wait for a bed might take days. Even mild illness can be fairly miserable and include more than a week of high fever, extreme fatigue, sore throat, and persistent headache. And studies indicate that all COVID infections, even mild ones, carry the risk of long COVID, with 1 in 10 patients suffering debilitating fatigue and impaired brain function more than 12 weeks after diagnosis. As effective therapies such as Pfizer's Paxlovid become widely available, holding off against getting COVID increases the chance of receiving state-of-the-art treatment. So don't give up now on masking or other common sense measures to avoid infection. Keeping Omicron out of your body is still in your best interest and the interests of those around you. Fauci sets the record straight. Anthony Fauci has finally had enough, said Lincoln Mitchell, the infectious disease expert who's advised every president back to Ronald Reagan. Finally fought back last week against the demagoguery of Senator Rand Paul, a leading figure in the COVID-19 denial movement, who has repeatedly accused the veteran scientist of forcing vaccination and masks on people for no reason, and even of helping Chinese scientists create the coronavirus in a lab. After a disinformation-filled diatribe by Paul during a Senate hearing, an indignant Fauci noted that the senator's reckless rhetoric kindles the crazies out there and has led to an avalanche of death threats against him and his children. Police recently arrested a California man driving to Washington, D.C. with an AR-15 and lots of ammunition, who told them he was on his way to kill Dr. Fauci. Fauci also pointed out that Paul's website has a Fire Dr. Fauci page that asks for contributions for Paul's re-election campaign. Now, Fauci is not a divine truth teller and is not beyond questioning or criticism. But over a 50-year career, he's proven that his primary motivation is safeguarding the public health. As Fauci said, Paul's cynical attacks on science, masks, and vaccines are motivated by political gain and are costing lives. This column comes from Pakistan. Time to open up to tourists. Why isn't Pakistan a big international tourism draw? Asked Camilla Hyatt. With our mountain landscapes and ancient mosques, we have more beautiful scenery than many other Muslim countries. Yet we don't encourage visitors to come here and spend money. Part of the problem is a failure of infrastructure. We haven't invested in the necessary roads and hotels, and where we do have vacationers, we don't take care of them. At least 23 Pakistani tourists froze to death while trying to reach the scenic mountain town of Miri last week, all because authorities failed to warn them of an approaching blizzard. But mostly what's holding us back is our own hang-ups. So much of what foreigners might want to do, listen to music, or drink alcohol, is prohibited in many of our most beautiful rural areas. It would be much easier to promote the pristine beaches of Baluchistan if women were allowed to wear bathing suits there. While it can be argued that these activities may go against our culture, plenty of other Muslim-majority nations, like the United Arab Emirates and Indonesia, have managed to accommodate religion and tourism. If authorities sit with local elders, they should be able to develop a plan to accommodate visitors in a way that doesn't offend anyone. Our feature article, The Last Word, is titled this week, sterilized by choice. Worried about the state of the world, an increasing number of young women say they don't want kids, said journalist Susie Weiss in barryweiss.substack.com, and getting the operation to make sure they never have them. Rachel Diamond looks like most of the moms at the Brooklyn Cafe where we meet. She's wearing a green T-shirt under a black corduroy jumper with sensible shoes and carries a smart leather bag. She sips a $4 iced chai, except the 31-year-old isn't a mom, and she never will be. You know, Diamond says cheerily, I never expected to be the poster child of sterilization. On the aspiring actor's TikTok, one finds short, funny videos about Diamond's job working the register at a Manhattan cafe and updates on her rescue pit bull, Rue, who has anemia. Mixed in are clips extolling her child-free life. They have titles like Sterilization Attempt Number 3 and Being Child-Free, We Do Know What We're Missing. It's been 5 months since she had her fallopian tubes cut, not tied, and she has 64,000 followers. Growing up in Hershey, Pennsylvania, Diamond always assumed she'd have a family of her own. Then came college at Arcadia University. Her political awakening, away from her conservative roots and toward progressivism, and a therapist she found online a few months after graduation, who made her realize that being spanked as a child was deeply traumatic, and that it made her fear authority figures like her father. She decided that she never wanted to be one herself. Never, ever, ever. Diamond is hardly an outlier. Excuse me, I missed a paragraph. Looking back, I never pretended that my American Girl dolls were children. They were always my sisters, she said. There were little things showing that I wasn't preparing myself for motherhood. I think for me, it's an innate as saying, I've always wanted to be a mom. Diamond is hardly an outlier. Americans are making fewer babies than we've made since we started keeping track in the 1930s. And some women, like Diamond, are not just putting off pregnancy, but eliminating the possibility of it altogether. Last year, the number of deaths exceeded that of births in 25 states, up from 5 states the year before. The marriage rate is also at an all-time low, at 6.5 marriages per 1,000 people. In or outside marriage, millennials also aren't having sex. The number of young men ages 18 to 30 who admit they have had no sex in the past year tripled between 2008 and 2018. Cities like New York, where young secular Americans flock to build their lives, are increasingly childless. In San Francisco, there are more dogs than children. It used to be that people wanted to make babies, women especially, but also men. That was a healthy young person's default position, and our existence depended on it. We wanted to do other things, of course, and the great post-feminist challenge was how to have it all. The proper work-life balance, the career and the baby, the supportive husband, and the adventurous life. But now, for an increasing number, the question isn't how to have it all, it's why do it at all? This psychological reversal didn't just happen. It took place inside the hurricane of spiritual, cultural, and environmental forces swirling around us. But the message from the young cohort is clear. Life is already exhausting enough, and the world is broken and burning. Who would want to bring new, innocent life into a criminally unequal society situated on a planet with catastrophically rising sea levels? As The New Yorker and NPR and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez all keep telling us, the end is upon us, and there is no time for onesies. I think it's morally wrong to bring a child into the world, said Isabel, 28, a self-proclaimed antinatalist who lives in southwestern Texas and did not want her last name in print. No matter how good someone has it, they will suffer. Texas' new highly restrictive abortion law has led her to take action sooner instead of later. I was going to wait until I was 30 to get the procedure done, Isabel said. But with the heartbeat bill in place, I can't take the risk of getting pregnant and not being able to abort. Last week, she was approved for the operation, a.k.a. laparoscopic bilateral salpingectomy. Many surgeons won't sterilize young childless women because studies indicate high rates of regret, so it can take time to lock one down. During the procedure, which she hopes will take place in the next few months, depending on COVID and the hospital's capacity to perform elective surgeries, Isabel's surgeon will make 3 incisions, 2 near her abdomen and 1 just above her belly button. This will allow the surgeon to insert cameras and then remove her fallopian tubes. Isabel is planning a sterilization celebration at a local sushi joint. There will be lots of booze, a smattering of friends, and her brother and his husband, who are also child-free. I don't want to work my life away, says Isabel, who hopes to retire in her 50s or earlier. Darlene Nickel, 31, in Denver, had her tubes removed 8 months ago. My generation is very aware of the ways that her parents traumatized us, she tells me. My mom smoked a lot of weed and did her own thing, and my dad was away a lot for work. She says her parents' marriage improved after they became empty nesters. She first set out to get sterilized at the age of 21 and was told by her doctor that she needed written consent from her male partner or to have already had 2 kids. Meantime, her childless male friend from high school had successfully gotten his vasectomy a year before. That felt like an attack on me. Nickel, who was surprised that her obstetrician agreed to sterilize her when she brought it up at a yearly checkup, is the self-proclaimed black sheep of her family, though she says her 2 younger sisters, 1 in her 20s and 1 in her teens, are likely to follow her lead. The 23-year-old is exploring sterilization herself. The other is feeling inspired by the child-free life. The child-free find one another on social media, mostly on Reddit. There's a child-free antinatalism and fence sitters as in. I'm on the fence about this whole kids thing. You can also find doctors who will sterilize you and how-to guides with tips and frequently asked questions like, can you trust a fence sitter boyfriend who doesn't want a vasectomy? Rachel Diamond's live-in boyfriend, Cameron Gilks, 33, introduced her to Reddit and her new family of people dead set against creating families. I asked to get a vasectomy at 24 and 26, said Gilks, who is hoping for any type of male contraceptive. One injectable called Vasogel has been stuck in trials for years before Diamond got sterilized. We'd been trying for a long time, she says. They met on eHarmony 7 years ago and came out to each other on their 2nd date. The script from the movie they saw that night, Interstellar, sits on a stuffed bookshelf next to The Feminine Mystique, Screenwriting for Dummies, and the Peter Pan Chronicles in the 2-bedroom apartment they share with a 3rd roommate they met through a friend. Child freedom, as Diamond and Gilks are child-free, not antinatalist, in that they don't think it's necessarily wrong for other people to procreate, comes with its own lingo. Brant means breeder rant, as in the annoying things people with kids tell people without kids about how great their life is with kids. Mombi is a haggard mom zombie, lost to the land of breast milk and binkies. Thinker is an acronym standing for 2 healthy incomes, no kids, early retirement. Bingoing refers to the question the child-free get asked by the child-full. What if your kid cures cancer? What if you regret it? Who will take care of you when you're older? The child-free have many reasons for not wanting babies. Fear of pregnancy, fear of authority, fear of preeclampsia, a pregnancy disorder that can lead to undesirable outcomes for the mother and baby. Fear of postpartum depression. and in Diamond and Gilks' case, racism. Diamond is white, Gilks is black, and they say they worry about what life would be like for a biracial baby in today's America. I wouldn't be able to say I understand if they came home from school and had been bullied for their hair or their skin color, Diamond said. I asked them if they ever thought about their own personal legacy, the people they would leave behind. The whole legacy thing makes me laugh, Diamond said. It's like, who do you think you are? Do you want your kid to be a founding father? That would make them a colonizer. Sophia, a 19-year-old communications student who goes to a small school in British Columbia and declined to give her last name for privacy reasons, was just approved for sterilization by her doctor in Canada. She told me she has a great relationship with her parents, who are super chill about her decision to be child-free, despite the fact they're both religious Christians. She has one sister who she says is pro-kid, or at least not anti, and though Sophia doesn't believe in God anymore, she's left behind the church she grew up in and its toxic culture. She describes herself as vaguely spiritual. She says taking the pill or using another non-permanent birth control would amount to kicking the can down the road, since she knows she doesn't want kids ever. I'm going to do this invasive thing once, rest for a few days, and never think about it again. The teen, who has a roommate named Emily and a part-time job at a grocery store, doesn't have a clear picture of her life besides traveling and maybe moving to the coast, away from the semi-desert grasslands where she lives now. In high school, she visited Ecuador and Kenya on humanitarian trips and has dreams to hit every continent. She was surprised that the doctor who will sterilize her in the coming months didn't ask about her sexual history. If she had, she would have found out that it amounts to little more than flirting and a few dates. I'm a virgin, and I was worried that she would send me off to have sex before she agreed to do it, Sophia says. She acknowledged that she may come down with a case of baby fever in her 20s, but that's just another risk that she's accepting. There's no point regretting what you can't change, she said. If she were to eventually find a partner who wanted kids, that would just be a deal breaker for me. She doesn't remember one moment that turned her off permanently to parenthood, but she never really liked being around other kids when she was one, and hated babysitting when she got older. I found it draining. According to Clay Routledge, an existential psychologist at North Dakota State who has studied young people's attitudes toward the future, there is a growing school of thought among 20-somethings that humans are the problem. It's not just that we've built factories and polluted the oceans and launched tons of garbage into space. It's that there's something about us, our psychology, our chromosomal wiring, that makes it impossible for us to make things better. They're saying the future isn't a good investment, Routledge says. And if there's no future, why would you be anything but hedonistic? Why would you donate to charities? Why would you try to make the world better or care about human progress? He adds that this generation has a sense that humans were a mistake. I used to think that all kids are bad, and I had a period in middle school where I was ultra-liberal, and I thought everyone should stop having kids, said Sophia in British Columbia. I chalk it up to emotional immaturity. As I got older, I realized that there was more to this, and I didn't have to be super uptight in my beliefs. I ask what she hopes her childless life will look like. What countries will she visit? Where will she live? What will she do with all of her free time? And what does she hope her career will be like? It's kind of hard to ask someone who is 19 and hasn't finished college what they want their life to look like, she tells me, a little annoyed. This was adapted from a story that originally appeared in Common Sense with Barry Weiss. Here's one of the obituaries. The pop star who escaped her abusive Svengali. Ronnie Spector, 1943 to 2022. Ronnie Spector's fortunes soared and fell with the 1960s. She rocketed to fame at the start of the decade as leader of the Ronettes, who with hair teased high, lashings of black eyeliner, and skin-tight dresses became one of the girl group era's most iconic acts. The trio, Ronnie, her older sister Estelle Bennett, and their cousin Nedra Talley, scored a string of hits with pop masterpieces such as Be My Baby and Baby I Love You, in which Ronnie's youthful but brass-tinged voice crested over Phil Spector's swelling wall of sound production. She married the producer in 1968 and ended the decade as a virtual prisoner. He was a brilliant producer, but a lousy husband, she said of Phil, who was later convicted of murder and died last year. But I still smile whenever I hear the music we made together, and always will. Veronica Bennett was born in Manhattan to an Irish-American father and a mother of black and Cherokee descent, said Variety. It was a musical family, and she, Estelle, and Nedra played New York sock hops and bar mitzvahs, first as Ronnie and the Relatives, and then as the Ronettes. In March 1963, Estelle secured an audition for the trio with Phil Spector. Ronnie had barely sung her first line when the 23-year-old producer jumped up and exclaimed, "That's the voice I've been looking for." The Ronettes flared hot, brightly, and quickly. They notched their first hit with 1963's Be My Baby and toured the UK with the Rolling Stones as their support act. But by 1966, Phil had lost interest, and the group disbanded the following year. Ronnie married the producer, hoping things would get better, said the Daily Telegraph. Instead, he kept her locked in their Beverly Hills mansion, which was surrounded by barbed wire and had a gold coffin in the basement. Her tomb, he said, should she ever try to leave. With her mother's help, she escaped from the mansion barefoot in 1972. Though the terms of her divorce denied Ronnie the rights to her 1960s hits, she kept finding new ways to reinvent herself, said Pitchfork. She sang on Eddie Money's 1986 mega hit, Take Me Home Tonight / Be My Baby, collaborated with kindred pop-punk sweetheart Joey Ramone, and served as an influence on Amy Winehouse. I'm so glad I'm still on this earth, she said in 2019, to see women going out there and saying, you can be fabulous like me. You can do anything. And we'll flip on over to the Talking Points page. Start with an article titled, Leah Thomas, Should She Race Against Women? Leah Thomas is either the best female college swimmer in the country or an affront to fairness of sports, said Jenna Stocker in the National Review. Thomas competed on the University of Pennsylvania men's team for three seasons before transitioning. After hormone replacement therapy, she qualified this season to race against women. Despite seeing her times drop about 5%, the 22-year-old is still winning most races by wide margins and shattering Ivy League women's records. As a former collegiate swimmer, I can only imagine how demoralized Thomas' competitors must feel. There is no chance this year, a parent of one of Thomas' teammates said. They train hard, but they know they cannot beat Leah. We should respect the new identities of trans athletes, said Dominic Green in the New York Post. But since the testosterone that comes with male puberty gives them bigger muscles and bones and more heart and lung capacity, isn't it discriminatory to let them compete against biological women who lack these advantages? The sudden right-wing obsession with college swimming should fool no one, said Mia Gingrich and Alex Peterson in the Los Angeles Blade. People are exploiting Thomas' story to push transphobic talking points, especially Fox News, which aired an absurd 32 segments on Thomas over the last month. Fox host Rachel Campos Duffy said flatly, Leah is not a woman while a guest on Tucker Carlson Tonight insisted that being transgender just doesn't exist. The culture war campaign to manufacture outrage against Thomas will only hurt trans children desperately looking for acceptance. Acceptance in society, yes, said Megan McArdle in the Washington Post, but in sports there is a sound biological reason for women to have their own competitions. Research has shown that going through puberty as a male gives competitors a 6% to 10% advantage in sports like swimming and track. That advantage makes Thomas, who is pretty good as a male swimmer, a superstar among women and maybe an Olympian. Maximal inclusion of trans people in society should be a moral duty, said Andrew Sullivan in his Substack newsletter. But it's absurd to claim that people are transphobic bigots if they don't accept activist claims that sex and gender are purely subjective and malleable, with no connection to biology. To believe biological gender differences exist is not hate. It's just sanity. The U.S., an epidemic of trauma and rage. After nearly 2 years of the pandemic, American society is fraying at the seams, said Matthew Iglesias in his Substack newsletter. An under-discussed impact of life amid COVID is that everyone is getting a bit more deranged and that we're confronting a broad rise in aggressive and antisocial behavior. We see it in the documented surges of reckless and inebriated driving, in shocking spike in air rage incidents, in attacks on healthcare workers and school board officials, and in students lashing out at teachers, trashing bathrooms, and getting into fights. Workers who face the public say Americans are devolving into children, said Sarah Lyle in the New York Times. They're screaming at waiters, throwing tantrums over sold-out items, and knocking out flight attendants' teeth. People are so wound up with worry and anxiety, workers say, that the smallest thing sends them into a tailspin of hysteria. Let's face it, we're suffering from collective trauma, said Marissa Iotti in the Washington Post. With Omicron feeling like the recurrence of a nightmare, many people are near a breaking point. Buckling under the stress of a long-lasting public emergency with no clear end point, not to mention supply chain shortages, extreme weather disasters, and bitter political and social divisions, Americans are bringing their internal struggles to bear on interactions with strangers. The problem is likely to get worse rather than better, said Stanford University psychiatry professor Thomas Plant in the San Jose Mercury News. Frustration aggression theory tells us that when people are chronically frustrated and then experience stressors, aggression will follow. Frustration intensified when we thought the pandemic was ending last spring, only to be hit with two successive new variants. People are asking, will this ever end? It's not just the pandemic, said David Brooks in the New York Times. Well before the coronavirus emerged, the nation was seeing soaring rates of depression, suicide, and overdoses. Something darker and deeper is afflicting our society. We can point to the usual suspects, including social media and Donald Trump's unleashing of the national id. He gave his followers permission to openly hate people, and his opponents to hate them back. But there must be also some spiritual or moral problem at the core of this. Americans are becoming more narcissistic, more aggressively tribal, more antisocial. Why? I honestly don't know. I just know the situation is dire. It's time for a few short notes. On average, at least one child is shot every hour of every day in the U.S. More than 2,200 American kids were killed by guns in 2020, by far the highest number in 20 years. And 2021's death toll is expected to be the worst. Billionaires' total wealth rose by $5 trillion between March 2020 and November 2021, according to a new Oxfam report, a bigger increase than in the previous 14 years combined. the wealth of the world's 10 richest people is now 6 times higher than that of the world's poorest 3.1 billion people. Numerous rioters who infiltrated the Capitol on January 6 called Nancy Pelosi's office the next day trying to recover items they'd lost during the insurrection. The rioters were asking whether there was a lost and found because they forgot their phones there, or they left their purse, said Representative Jamie Raskin, Democrat from Maryland. He said the callers were put through to police officers who took down their names and addresses. Melania Trump is auctioning off the hat she wore during a 2018 event at the White House for personal profit, an unprecedented action for a former first lady. The white, wide-brimmed crepe hat is being auctioned along with a watercolor painting of Trump wearing the hat and a non-fungible token of the artwork, with a starting bid of $250,000. Trump said some of the proceeds will go to charity, but declined to say how much. And we'll finish with a quote from author Marilynne Robinson, who said, "It is worth living long enough to outlast whatever sense of grievance you may acquire." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten by the law firm of W.G. Alexander & Associates. Alexander attorneys provide top-rated and experienced legal counsel for concentrating on estate planning, elder law, special needs, and asset protection. Call W.G. Alexander & Associates at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.